Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. Not to tell you people, you know, I've had some health problems, you know, with the heart thing and all that. But I've been on some medication for, I have AFib, which is my heart rate is irregular. And my other heart stuff or the other congestive heart failure I have, that stuff that's generic, they're cheap. But this, for some reason, is so generic. So the company that makes Pradaxa really screws me. I mean, basically, I have to pay after my insurance and after their discount, I pay $175 a month, which is just awful. But I feel awkward today because I went to my doctor, and he thinks my AFib may be disappearing. So I'm hooked up to all these monitors. And my guests can't tell. I have on the side what looks like, honestly, looks like a beeper. I look like a drug dealer from the 80s. And then it comes up, and I have like one of those things wrapped around my back, and then it comes up when I have five chest monitors on me. And I canceled my show tonight because I was going to do this 10-minute set down in Universal City, but I was a little worried because not for these microphones, but they told me to keep my cell phone on the other side of this monitor, and I really don't want to go on stage with a microphone hooked up because usually it's a crappy microphone, the sound system, and I was afraid I was going to explode. So today is going to be weird because I've never slept with a monitor, and I feel like RoboCop. But enough about me. We have a great guest today, and I found out he's from my home area, right next door. Well, part of Cherry Hill. We have Alan Steven. How you doing, Alan?
How you doing? And by the way, I've worn that thing several times.
Have you? Now, it's weird because like they have like if anything bothers you, push this button.
You have a new one. When I wore them, you had it was like a purse you carried over your shoulder and.
Okay, because I have it around the back, and it's mm-hmm. I was like, because, I mean, anything to get rid of that damn medicine, because I swear, the rest of my heart medicine is like, between all of them, it's like $18, but for some reason, they can't do the AFib, they can't make a generic, and so they go, oh, well, you need it else, you're going to have a stroke.
I get it with all my pills.
Do you have heart problems?
I had cancer.
Okay.
And I beat it, but they took my thyroid and a few other things, so I have to take like 8, 9, 10 pills a day. So I go through... like I had to have this heartburn medicine, and I ordered it, and they go $1,000. I go a month, so I had to fight that.
$1,000 a month
for heartburn.
For heartburn, like an antacid.
Mm-hmm.
How do they justify that? That's what cracks me up. It's like, you know, it's I have the same problem with the pharmaceutical companies, which is so funny. My one friend is a writer. His wife went through cancer, and he said it's unbelievable because you go into the offices and they sit there and. They're trying to get her to switch to this medicine. And then he looks and every pen and pad is that medicine. And he's like, screw off, man. It's they're like veterinarians. Like they're supposed to love pets, yep. But it's just crazy.
They all have side effects. And when you actually have cancer, if there's a new medicine, they call it experimental and no insurance covers it.
Okay.
That was about $7,500 a week.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's just amazing. Well, what happened with did you sue them about the $1,000 pills? Is that what you said? Or?
I'm the Writers Guild, so I had to fight the guild. And they finally said, okay, but you have to every 3 or 6 months renew it. So finally I got a lovely lady at the Writers Guild, and I said, seriously, I'm going to be on this the rest of my life. Do I really have to talk to you every 3 months?
Right.
She said, I'll take care of it.
See, that's good. That's like for me, because the Pradaxa, it's like, the AFib runs in the family, and I want to get rid of it just because after that, they already took me off two medicines. Then I have to take the blood pressure, which, and the diuretic, because congestive heart failure makes you pee. And you feel like an idiot when you say you're taking a diuretic. It's like, no, people, it doesn't make me take a dump.
Now, is it hereditary because you're in good shape?
Yeah, that's the weird thing. My dad recently passed, but he was 88, and he had beaten colon cancer. He had a quadruple bypass. My grandfather, and we're talking ages ago, had like 3 heart attacks. My uncle, you know, and it's hereditary, but, you know, I smoked. I drank a lot. And I ate crap food, and I did comedy on the road in the early 80s. I won't say what else. And it's just a different lifestyle. And what happened to me was my doctor said I had a respiratory infection. So mm-hmm. I took the medicine, and I just got insurance. That's the best thing. I got insurance a week before I went to the hospital.
You are so lucky.
Yeah, my bill would have been 40-something thousand. It was $1,900. I mean, it's just you're sitting there going, wow. And I only was paying $150 a month. So my buddies are like, well, you know, you can't get insurance. It's too expensive. I'm like, guys, I'm almost 50. I was paying $150 a month. But no, it happened. I kept going back, and he kept saying the same thing, and I'm trying to do my show. I have no energy. I'm drinking 5-hour energy. I feel like I'm going to die. Finally, they go, you have congestive heart failure. But I've just learned. I right there, I quit smoking.
Well, those energy drinks are the worst thing for you.
Yeah, they're awful. But anyway, it's just so funny that, you know, I'm bitching people because mine was $170 a month. This guy's paying $7,500 a week. Anyway, so earlier you said you've been in show business since you were 8.
Yeah.
Now, what were you? What was your family in the show business? Because you were in Ashland, New Jersey. You're not too far from Philly.
My mother was a model.
Okay.
So around 8, I did catalogs, Sears catalogs, that kind of thing. And around, I think, 9 or 10, she said, "You want to do TV commercials?" And it got me out of school, so I said yes.
So now you were doing it. Were you going to New York or were you shooting in Philly?
Yeah, I would take a Trailways bus from Morristown right there off the, Turnpike?
Yeah.
To New York. My manager would meet me, Florence Creasy, who was an old woman then and a drunk. We'd go to lunch. I would order a Coke. She'd say, "No, milk and a hamburger," and she'd have four martinis and cross me against the lights.
How old were you?
I was 11 then.
So you were going up there. Not weird. I'm trying to think of the word. Just you take the bus by yourself.
Eventually, I did.
But
yeah,
see,
from
back
about
then,
11 on.
Back then, you could. That's the weird thing. Like back then, I remember taking the bus one time to Atlantic City for something, and it was like, and it stopped, and some old African American got off. Like he looked like a blues player. He's like, "Yeah, had a shot at the little bar, like on Route 30," and it was such a different time. And it's in the buses. I mean, people would now. It's like. The buses are different, but
well, it was just the run to New York, which is about two and a half hours, I guess, by that bus. But it was I just remember had to be when Batman aired because I remember saying to the bus driver I wanted to get home for that premiere. So that'd be 65, 66.
Okay. So you were doing that, and then you how long did you do the commercials and stuff like that?
For about 4 or 5 years, and then they decided I should be in high school without show business and try to be normal. That really didn't work out.
And you went to Eastern?
Yeah, I went to Eastern Regional High in Voorhees in Gibbsboro, and I was the biggest thing out of there until Kelly Ripa.
Well, she's actually from Berlin.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Berlin, Gibbsboro, and Ashland all went to Eastern.
Okay, because my girlfriend lives in Marlton. And actually, it's so funny. A good friend of mine, Mike Colino, he used to own, his family used to own Pre Cleaners down on the White Horse Pike, and there's a bunch of them. But he lives in Voorhees now, and man, Voorhees has changed. I mean, it's just like he has a beautiful house, and it's like that's like where Cherry Hill used to be the place to live. Now it's Voorhees.
Yeah, when I moved there, it was Cherry Hill. In fact, Voorhees didn't even have like an area code, a zip code, I mean. We had like 5, 6 of them. We were Delaware County, Camden County, something RFD, and it was a very small. In fact, I was the first graduating class in Eastern High to do the full 4 years.
Okay, so you graduated high school. You weren't acting at that point. Now,
I stopped for about 3 years.
So then, what's your course of action? Because I know you ended up doing comedy, but what was your course of action after you got out of?
To lie about wanting to go to college in New York, which I did, and I majored in pool, and I was very good at making money and hustling. And I dropped out 6 months later and went back to the acting.
So you're in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what college did you go to?
New York Institute of Technology. Name one other person that went there. You can't.
No, you must be smart. I mean, if you get into technology, I mean, for me, it's like you think of MIT, New York Technology.
This school was, how do I put this? This school said no to nobody.
Okay, all right, it's one of them. It's like there's certain law schools like that. They go, "I graduated, that's all I go." Well, then got in.
Their campus was in Long Island.
Okay.
But they started one in Manhattan, and it was in the old New Yorker Hotel.
Okay, so.
And I stayed in the Wellington Hotel, which was right next door to Carnegie Hall. So all I did is put on a T-shirt, dirty it up, get some wires off the back of a truck, carry them into the Carnegie Hall and hide, and I saw all the concerts for free.
See, you were a creative at the time.
I was a hustler.
So you're playing pool, and you're hustling people. You're out of college, but are you still wanting to act?
That's all I wanted to do. So, stand-up was not in my plan.
Were you getting auditions and stuff like that as you were hustling, or were you getting work, or how did that work? Because it must have been very different in New York back then.
I did plays. The biggest thing I came close to, here, I'll tell you some funny stories.
Yeah, please.
First thing that I come close to, I think I'm around 13, is I auditioned for Disney.
Okay.
On the East Coast. They love me. I go through a million auditions, and then they tell me Mr. Disney's flying to meet me. So I go to New York with my mother. My big thing used to be put quarters in those vibrating beds in the old New York hotels. And we go, and you had to sing, dance, and play an instrument. So we're sitting there, and a woman comes out, talks to my mother. My mother whispers to me. She says, Mr. Disney's a little tied up. You're going to see his right-hand person. I said, that's not anyone like you. So, you know, as a kid, the desk seemed gigantic. I'm sure it was normal. So I go in, and I play my drumsticks across her desk, and I'm tap dancing. I go, what a day for a daydream. You know, I'm singing that. And she starts crying. She said, you have to leave. So I get outside, and I go, Mom, I made her cry. And you have to know my mother. She's very cut and dry. She goes, Mr. Disney's dead. Get in the elevator. Yeah.
What timing? I'll tell you. It's all
he
about
had
the time.
Cancer for about a year and a half. Didn't tell. You know, no, they didn't go public with it, but he died the night before.
So you didn't get that audition?
No, and it was the one and only original family band. I think Kurt Russell and a few others were in it. Then at 17, a producer named Hilly Elkins, who was married to famous actress, her name will come to me. There was a book called 100 Misunderstandings that was written in the 50s. It's like a graduate type feel.
Okay.
It's an Ivy League kid who goes to school, flunks out. His grandmother gives him $100, not knowing he flunked out for his birthday. And he goes to the whore section, finds a 15-year-old black whore, and it's about their weekend together. And she's smarter than him because of the street sense. So I audition. They love it. They love it. Hilly loves me, loves me, loves me, loves me. I sign a paper. It says I'm willing to do a nude scene, you know, and I'm underage. My parents had to sign. They say, pack your bags. You're going to California. And the running gag for years after this with my father was, I used to say, quit your job. I got it. Quit your job. You don't have to work anymore. So the phone rings. It's Hilly. He's getting a divorce from Claire Bloom.
Okay.
So the project's on hold. Like, comes to find out Claire Bloom and him own the project. So it's now in divorce hell.
Oh, man.
So now I audition. You know, I get little parts here and there. Then I get a play, and they send me to work with this Russian woman for voice. And it was great, because it's right out of the movie. She had an accent and a cane.
Okay.
And a gay piano player. And if you didn't hit certain notes, you'd get smacked with the cane. It was the most amazing. You know, when you're a kid, you don't know to say, hey, what the hell?
Right, right.
And so to this day, I can vocalize. You can hear me in a stadium.
That's funny.
And then after that, it didn't happen too much. So I went home, and I used to book bands in the Hyatt in Cherry Hill.
Okay.
In that whole area.
On 70,
mm-hmm.
Right near the Latin Casino.
And I worked for a company that had a recording studio and stuff. But the man I worked for, it turns out, wasn't the boss. It was a front for the mob. So I worked there for about 10 months, and I was doing really well at it because video had just come in. So all these clubs had to go see the bands live. I went and taped my bands.
Okay.
And used to just wheel it in, you know, like it was a visual aid in high school.
Right,
that's
right,
how
right.
Big everything was.
Yeah.
You know, the VHS machine was like a ton.
Right.
And I booked all the bands real quickly. And then I got tired of that. And I ran a nightclub across from the Garden State Racetrack.
What nightclub?
Steak and Brew. It had two restaurants and a jumping bar.
Wait a second. Wait. Where's it across? Right
across from the Garden State Racetrack, it's set.
Wow, you know, I remember because it's changed now.
I think then it became
Valentino's, yes, because right across years ago from there, there was a place, I remember called Steak and Brew. I remember that now. It sounds familiar because I was thinking of Steak and Ale that closed also. But right across from the Valentino's, there used to be a garden center.
Yep.
And we used to, me and my buddy Mark Esposito would go with my mom, and she would let us leave, and we'd go, and there was a tank. Army tank. We used to climb all over that. That's funny because then Valentino's, then it became something else, and then the Diamond Diner was right next door.
Well,
all of that's gone.
Since it's years ago, I will tell you that I believe it was Valentino's. My mother was a settlement clerk. She
okay.
Had her own company.
It was owned by the Gambinos.
Yes, and here's how I know. My mom did the settlement deal, and she called me up. She said, Alan, could you come here and drive me to the bank? I said, why? She said, I have nothing but shoeboxes full of cash.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Wow, that makes sense.
Yeah, she says, they came in with shoeboxes full of cash. They must be wealthy. I go, you think?
Yeah.
You know, my mom's so naive. Yeah, they just don't believe in banks, Mom.
it's under their mattress.
Yeah, so I did that.
Now, did you book any big bands or in that area?
It was always a band out of Philly I loved. It was a brother and sister. She played the drums. He was the greatest keyboard player I ever heard. And it started out, okay, here's my comedy background. It started out I was dating a girl there. And I would get up on stage in their lounge and screw around.
Okay.
I never had any intention of doing comedy, but I'd make fun of the South Philadelphia guys. How
right.
Hard was it? White belts and shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Guidos.
Yeah. So one of the managers says, hey, want to make the lounge yours on Friday and Saturdays? So I turn it into a jump in place. The owner comes in and says, how would you like to be a manager? I said, yeah, all right. So all the other managers hate me because you had to go to steak and ale school. And I didn't. I worked there for about 7 months, and then one of the supervisors I didn't care for. So I packed up the car, and I moved to California.
And that was how you – but did you get the bug and stand up when you got up there? Did you?
No. I was on the roof in West Hollywood at a party, and I met Mitchell Walters.
Okay, I worked with him years and years ago at the comic strip in Fort Lauderdale, mm-hmm. and he would just go up on stage and command it. So you left California. I mean, you left Philly to come to California. What year is that?
75.
Okay, and you came out to act or just say, I need a change?
I came out to act. I didn't know anybody. There's a place, I don't know if it still exists, Ogner Porsche and Volkswagen. And I knew Ogner in New York. He was like an Olympic tumbler. So for money, he would tumble in front of the movie lines. You know, in New York, it's always a line. And I would do nothing and walk along and take all the applause credit and take the money. So when I moved out here, he said, come stay with me. And I didn't know he was a very wealthy kid. So I stayed with him. And God, when I moved out here, it was a whole different ballgame. And so I'm on this rooftop. And there's, I can't remember his name from Car 54. Ooh, Tootie. Oh,
I know who you're talking. Yeah, I can't. I know who you're talking about.
Well, he's one of my idols. And I go over, and he's like on the side of the roof. And I go, oh, man, I can't believe you're here. And I reach out to shake his hand, and he's peeing off the roof. He says, give me a minute, kid. And there was another comic named Robert Lord, and I started hanging with them, and I find out they're at the Comedy Store.
Now, there wasn't a lot of comedy back then, though, right?
There was the Improv and the Comedy Store, and the Comedy Store was, the original room was a quarter of the size it is now. She didn't own it. It was the big room was a Mexican disco run by Art LeBeau.
Let me interrupt real quick. It was Joe E. Ross. Was that it?
Yep.
Okay, I had to check real quick. Yeah, because it was Fred Grimm with Herman Munster.
Yeah.
That.
It's always nice to go up to one of your childhood heroes, and he's peeing off the roof. Hey, class act all the way.
So you met Mitchell there.
And another comic named Robert Lord, who got out of the business.
Okay, and then they told you to come down and do stand-up?
No, I hung with them, and they said, you're funny, you ought to try it. So I didn't know from comedy. I put together a prop act. She needed comics. So I got in the first time.
That must be so weird now because it's like there's so many comics. And I always crack up.
Weird?
I mean.
I'm going to give you a Kippadada story if you know who he is.
I know. He used to work at a.
At the beginning of this thing of comedy spreading like a disease, he's somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And he's getting gas. And the guy says, hey, aren't you a comedian? Kip goes, why, yes, I am. He goes, hey, me too. I'm playing at the bowling alley down the street tonight. You know, it's a disease now.
Yeah, it was so crazy.
You watch TV and go, I can do that.
Yeah, well, I used to book at Flappers. I used to book a female show called Cooper's Angels. But when I started out in Philly, and this is probably 88, we had like four female comics. Now, everywhere.
Well, by 88, though, there was more clubs. See, the first clubs opened in like 81, 82.
So you were doing it. You started at the Comedy Store what year?
At 75.
Okay, now what did you, once you started working, I mean, you would get a lot of stage time. Was there a place to go on the road for you, or what did you guys do?
All she had was La Jolla.
Okay, and there was nothing, there was no other really places?
No.
So what did you do for a living?
I worked... Actually, I ran the Westwood Comedy Store for a couple of years.
Okay.
I think one time I worked making sandwiches, and when Mincy Shore found out, she sent me to La Jolla, and that's when I really broke out and became a headliner, and I'm the longest person ever played down there. I played down there for 7 months straight.
Really? So you went down there. Now, you're still newer in the business, right?
I had just become a headliner.
Okay.
For her.
And so, I mean... So did you live down there, or how did that work?
I stayed in her condo. And Pauly Shore stayed with me, so I had him from about 12 to 14.
Wow, but seven, that's just insane to think that, you know, but I mean, it's just, especially because I lived in San Diego for a while, it's touristy, but not that touristy, like L.A.
The beach.
Okay.
There was no road. The beach was right there. There's now a road that goes by. Women all day long. I'm at the club all night long. It was just a buffet.
That's,
I don't know any other way to put it.
It's funny.
And they would wait in line for me. I was so big down there at the time, the KGB radio station down there.
Okay.
I would fill in for the number one show people, sometimes with Bruce Baum. We'd do BS in the morning.
Okay.
Baum and Steven. But it was great. And then the first club I headlined was the Denver Comedy Works. when it was called Basin's Up, a jazz club that was upstairs.
Now, what year was this?
This is 81, maybe.
So comedy is starting to take off, but it's not there yet.
They don't even know. They just want to try it. It's okay. Basin's Up. I'm like, maybe the first guy, maybe the second guy in. And I finish the show, and the place goes nuts. I'm in the dressing room, and there's powder there, so I throw it on my face like I'm all coked up, and the owners come in, and they go, oh, man, great show. You know, and they're laughing. They go, hey, well, they're going to love you again next show. I go, what do you mean they're going to love me again next show? Because we don't turn the audience, you know, because comedy was new. I go, I have one joke left. And they're doing what you're doing. They're laughing like, yeah, you're such a funny guy. And I'm really in a cold sweat.
Because they don't know. They don't know that
my
we actually craft an act.
I have one joke. So I don't know. Basically, what I do is today is what started then. I'm very improvisational, and I make everything up. I did another hour and 15 minutes, and I came off, and they go, no material.
So that's funny. But and probably the funny thing is you probably didn't tape it. And
I taped myself twice the entire time I'm in the business, audio-wise, because I can't stand my voice.
But see, I used to tape, but I never listened to it. So I said, why am I taping it? I know what I'm going to do, and half the time I riff it anyway. So it's like, I don't know what order I'm going to go in, and it's like, what people are, and it's like, it's not as much of a science as you think it is, guys.
No, somebody, I always tell anybody, once you feel comfortable being funny, it's all smoke and mirrors. Then from there, it was just headlining, and you'd go and you were a king. Because these clubs were brand new.
It's funny because
they'd keep you in a hotel. They'd give you whatever you wanted. Now, as they became six to a town, now you're in a comedy condo, which I used to always refuse to stay in. And I used to get a piece of the bar in the beginning because I could do 2 hours.
Okay.
So I'd leave places with $7,000. And then they're catching on as these places are opening. You go, well, we're only going to give you $3,000. And,
I was talking to a young comic last night, and we were talking about that movie, I Am Comic, and Rich Scheidner's been on the show a few times, and mm-hmm. I was saying to him, this comic, I was like, it was so different back then. I said, these guys made, there wasn't 7-minute free sets. These guys, you know, you weren't booking a show up, having them bring people. These guys were treated like rock stars. And Rich Scheidner said the same thing. Like, you would be on the road, and people would call and go, oh, yeah, by the way, we just opened a club here. So you would go to that club, and you would
I only played a handful because I have a bad attitude. I don't like authority. And these club owners, you know, think, you know, like I had a guy one night say, hey, you're not going to do that heckling crap you do, are you? I said, no. We're sitting at his bar, and I call the bartender over, and I go, we're not selling Budweiser tonight. And the owner goes, what are you talking about? And I go, we're partners now, right? I said, shut the hell up. I'm here for a week. Don't have me back. And that's how I worked. And they would want me back, and if I didn't like them, I didn't go.
Okay.
So the ones I worked, like Rascals in Jersey, I could call them up and go, I'm bored this week, or I need money. They'd cancel somebody and fly me in. Denver was that way. La Jolla with the comedy. So I had about six.
Did you ever play Philly?
No.
Okay.
I went once. Is there something works there?
Comedy Works. There's Comedy Factory Outlet and Comedy Works.
Whoever that guy was.
Steve Young.
I come in recommended by everybody. But, you know, again, at this point, they think they're in show business.
And there, a lot of these guys were guys who wanted to do comedy who just sucked at comedy.
So he says to me, well, I'll try you out on 2 one-nighters I have. One is a synagogue, and he thinks I'm a Jew, so it'll kill. Well, I don't look Jew-Jewish.
I do, but I'm not.
Well, the Jews think I'm mocking them.
Oh, wow.
But the next night's a college, and it's apeshit crazy how well it went. So he goes, God, that college. I said, so when are you booking me? Well, you know, I go, you know what? And there was a restaurant downstairs.
Yeah, the Middle East restaurant.
Yeah, we're sitting there.
Because it was three levels.
And he's got his buddy there, and I think I had a friend of mine there. And he goes, you know what I'm thinking? I go, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking you should.
Right.
Go screw off.
So now this is, now what year is it? This you're playing these clubs, but you're going a lot. Like you said, Rascals. And then you have the comedy.
Up until about 85 when I start The Outlaws of Comedy with Sam Kinison.
Okay, now did you start, or how did that all come about? Because I know you had
The Outlaws of Comedy, Sam started when he was struggling in Texas, so it had Bill Hicks and a bunch of other guys that weren't as funny as him. And we were friends in a weird way, Sam and I. When he came out, he wanted to meet two people, me and Richard Belzer. So okay. I was the guy he looked up to.
Now, had he seen you perform on TV or at the clubs?
He had been out here before. So he's, you know, just wants to meet us. So he used to come to my house with his entourage that he always had every day. and sit at my feet. And then as he, the relationship got weird. So we didn't talk for a while.
Why did it get weird?
Jealousy on his part, I believe.
Okay.
You know, he was a real jealous and insecure guy. So we get back together as he after he did his first special. And we used to jam all the time. You know, he played guitar, and we said, if anybody
makes
it.
You play drums?
Yeah. If anybody makes it, we'll start a band. So he said, hey, Alan, I used to do this thing called The Outlaws. Want to do it with me and Carl? Sure.
And that was Carl LeBeau.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's how our version started. And then we had about seven guys over the 2 years to try to find a third one. And then I bought in Mitchell. But we had Belzer. Lenny Clark lasted a long time. Bunch of guys here and there.
So you guys would go on a tour or would just hit comedy clubs? How would that work?
Well, as...
Especially how would it do with all the
headliners?
Here's exactly how it worked.
Sam was with APA, and he was getting $10,000 a night. A buddy of mine calls me up and says, we'll offer you $25,000 for the Outlaws and Sam. So I tell Sam, and his agent says, well, Bill Graham, because it was near San Francisco, won't hire you then. It's too near his territory. So Sam always put me on the spot, and we go in, and I'm talking to the agent. The agent goes, tells me that story. And I go, well, how much is Bill Graham offering? Because Bill Graham doesn't even know who the hell Sam is. I go, exactly. We're taking the $25,000 gig, and from now on, he's $25,000 a night. If you don't understand that, maybe he needs another agent. Long story short, we do it. The guy who wrote I Love You Jeopardy shows up. This is when the band starts, too. And so does
Greg Ken.
And so does Paul Kantner and Gray Slick.
Yeah, okay. Jeopardy.
So they're all, you know, playing with us on stage, and it goes well. I think about 8 months later, Bill Graham pays $100,000.
How? Oh, good. That's just so funny. It's demand. How did you guys do the lineup, though? Because, I mean, I'm sure there was egos because Sam had looked up to you,
well,
but then Sam was the bigger name. How did that work
Sam
out?
Sam did not like when I played with the audience.
Okay.
So after a couple times, and this is true, I was a better MC than Mitchell, couldn't get it together. Carl was too physical, and I knew how to run a show. I've been in show business forever.
Right.
So it would go, and it, before Mitchell, whatever it was me, whoever, Carl, or me, Carl, whoever, and Sam. Then as the show grew, it would be the three of us, a break in Sam. Then a break, Sam, and he'd play piano, and we'd all come out. And we eventually, as we got bigger, we'd have to play these places every 6 months, so we'd have to change up the shows. And then we put the band in, and that comes up. Sam and I are in a strip club in Las Vegas with Billy Idol.
Okay.
All the women are down the other end dancing to White Wedding with Billy. And Sam turns to me and goes, God, we need a song. So Leslie West from Mountain says, why don't you do Wild Thing? Boom. And he gets Jessica Hahn, who was bringing down the church at the time.
I remember listening to all that stuff because Stern had just come to Philly. And I remember, mm-hmm. and I had been starting out and do comedy, and I had Sam's cassette. I used to drive my little Fiero to shows and play with a cassette. And for a comic, it was such an eye-opening thing because it's like, you know, wow, these guys are like rock stars. And I remember when that video came out. Now, did you play the drums in the video?
I'm going to tell you.
Are you in the video?
I'm in the video, but the drummer on the video is Tommy Lee.
Really?
Yeah. And that whole video came about. Marnie Colner, who directs all the great videos and specials, and for 100 years, he's just the best. Had this idea about religion. And when Sam got to the set, it was all these religious things. He said, I'm not doing this. So Sam was managed by a rock agency. That's how we got all the rockers.
Okay.
And we lucked out with Jessica Hahn. We ad-libbed that thing, and there it is.
Wow, that's just so... And that was so funny, because the only time you really had comedy and music at that level before then was Rap and Rodney.
Well, after that, we are like rock stars. We travel with 3 buses. Women follow us in their cars. It was insanity. We're now playing stadiums.
Yeah, that's just what kind of venue? You're playing outdoor stadiums or like the Spectrum, like those kind of places?
Nassau Coliseum, Spectrum. Yeah.
Now, as a comic, and you were still going on first?
Mm-hmm.
I've always wondered, and it's just so funny, because I mean, I played 4th and B in San Diego once, and it was like 2,500 people. But as a comic, for you, and I know because you were used to clubs and stuff like that, how is it adjusting to performing in front of 20? I mean, it's 20,000.
You just have to go slower.
Okay.
Because the sound bounces. So you just have to talk slower. That's it.
But what's the feeling like when you get this insane laugh? All this almost blow you off the stage? I mean, it must be insane.
It was just as insane as doing a show that's great in front of 200 people.
Okay.
You know, one time we did the Rascals, and my parents came to see us, and they said, my God, it was like watching the Beatles. Our clothes were ripped off as we left the stage. I mean, it was hot there for a while. But because of comedy, and I'm not bragging, I'm just stating facts because I'm in the middle of writing a book, I have slept with more women, just like rock stars.
Well, yeah, you guys get done your show, and you have a line of women. I mean, did you guys?
It depends on where
sick,
we were because Sam would travel in the beginning with two twin blondes.
Okay,
and if I had a girlfriend, she came, or you know, somebody had a wife. But later on, then it was Malika, the one he married, and her sister, who I eventually married.
Okay,
and so Sam would go off with them, with Malika. And either be a fight or he'd stay with her or lie. But we did one tour. I have a jacket from every strip club in the country that we stopped in. They would literally close the club at 9 o'clock.
Because you guys were there?
Just close it, throw everybody out, and it was ours. I mean, it was insanity what went on.
Tell me a few.
We were in Rolling Stone. How many guys, you know, are, you know.
I know. Just tell me some crazy. I love this kind of stuff. That's why I do this show. And it's like, you know, like when Shiner tells stories, or Rick Overton was telling a story about a ferret biting his face, weird stuff. Just tell me some really, because this is like comedy history.
I'll give you two of my favorites.
Okay.
Sam didn't like anybody driving but me if we weren't on buses. So we did a short tour of Arizona, San Diego.
What were you guys driving? What, a van? Or
I think I had a van.
Okay.
Yeah, we're in the van. And as you leave Arizona, we're now up about two and a half days. As we leave Arizona, they look for fruits and vegetables at the stop.
Right.
So now we're in San Diego, and I sleep a little bit. These guys, not at all, because they just follow everything Sam says. We do the show, you know, now we're driving the next morning home. So you got to come through San Diego where there's that other stop.
Right.
And from Jersey, I found Jersey peaches that morning at a stand.
Wow,
I'm eating one, it's dripping down my hand, and there's three in a bag on the dashboard. Sam's next to me cutting blow on a CD cover, and he looks up and he sees the crossing, throws my peaches out the window and goes, What are you, nuts? Now, I pull over, and I go, Sam, this crossing looks for illegal aliens. Get out and get my peaches.
He says, but they can see. Peaches,
damn it. But they can see me. And I go, Sam, I'll do peach time.
That's great. And plus, because when you get a Jersey peach, I've digressed from the tomato, but then when you go back and you have the Jersey tomato, you go, wow, now you come out. Yeah, the corn, I think it was just because I wasn't used to white corn. The corn out here is fine, but it's Jersey peaches and the Jersey tomatoes.
Yep.
And it's so random that they're just because they're so far from each other.
Yep.
You know, so okay, so tell me another story.
I'll actually give you two more.
Okay.
I want to see the Redwoods. Never seen them. We're asked to do a celebrity baseball game by David Foster in Victoria Island, Canada. So
okay.
We decide to drive. So we get...
Now, how far of a ride is that?
From here to Canada.
I mean...
And then a ferry to Victoria Island. It's days.
Okay. Why did you decide to drive?
Because I wanted to see the Redwoods. And we're idiots. So Sam... We get four Lincolns, right? Sam and the two girls are in one. I'm in another. And we're running each other off the road. Coming home, we realized we were on cliffs. We were doing this at night. We didn't know it. So about 4 in the morning, Sam's skids his caddy into the middle of the road and literally spins it around, stops, turns on his high beams. He goes, there's your shitting tree. Let's go. That's all I saw of it. So now we get to Canada. I'm not driving. And he says, listen, I got to stop and bury my guns. So literally 300 feet is the border crossing is a fat guy digging a hole in the field and putting two guns. They're still there. Now, he says to me when he comes back, hey, do me a favor. Could you drive me and the girls across? I'm tired. Now, when I don't shave, I have a beard now, and I've been up. I look like everybody they're looking for.
Okay.
So Lincoln goes through. They look at me and they go, would you pull over there, please? So we pull over, and Sam gets out of the car. The two girls get out of the car. I think Sabrina might have been 17. She was underage. And I say, what's going on? So we're going to search your car. I go, why? Because we don't like the way you look. So Sam goes, where's the men's room? This is a border crossing. So he goes to the men's room. We sit down on the bench right in front of the car. The cop pops the trunk, opens it, and he goes, "You don't even put it in a suitcase, in a bag? There's just pot sitting there." And I go, "What are you talking about?" And he holds up the pot, and I go, "That's not my car. It's the fat guy." With that, now this is, it's dark. With that, we look, Sam is running into Canada. He ran through that thing that goes up and down. He's gone into the night. So now they take us inside, and the guy says, "Listen, is there anything you want to tell us? We're bringing out dogs to go over that car." And I go, "Yes, we rented it from a rock agency in L.A., and who knows what the rockers do in this car." And the guy looks at me and goes, "You're good." Comes back, he says, "The dogs found nothing." I go, "Well, then your dogs are high. That car's loaded with blow." And it was. We put it in the vent. I don't know how they didn't find it.
They didn't find it. That's amazing.
So we're sitting there, and every time he comes in the room, I look through the shades. He goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "I'm looking for the fat guy." "What are you, an idiot? You just let somebody run into your country?" He goes, "Who are you people?" I go, "Believe it or not, the fat guy with the beret is a star." "What?" I go, "We're here to play," and everybody in Canada knows this.
Okay, y'all know the benefit?
Yeah.
Okay.
I go, "We're here to do David Foster's baseball charity." He goes, "Who are you people?" I go, "We're comics." He goes, "Give me a minute." And he comes back and he says, "We're going to weigh the pot. If it's over an ounce, you're not allowed in this country ever." I go, "Hey, geez, I'm crying. You know, like, I want to go to Canada." So he comes back and he goes, "Okay, it's under an ounce, but we decided you have to pay to get the car back. $500 fine." Malika rolls Sam every night when he falls asleep. She literally pulls out, I don't know, like a 7-inch rolled wad of hundreds. The guy looks and he goes, "What is with you people?" And she counts off five. And as he's walking us out, you hear this over the loudspeaker, "Alan Steven, telephone call, Alan Steven." And I turn to the cop and I go, "I don't have any friends that live on the border. Where's the nearest phone?" He said, 2 miles into Canada. I go, "Go get the fat guy." He goes, "We just want you people gone." I drive 2 miles into Canada, they're in the phone booth, Sam's flagging me down. He gets in the car, and the girls go, "He was great. He got us out of it. He made the guy laugh." And Sam goes, "Well, I knew he could handle it." And I cold popped him right in the mouth.
That's so funny. It must have been, I mean, you guys are good friends, but he was a leader then by that point. Like, he was, I mean, was it just out of, I mean, it must have constantly been out of control.
Yeah.
I mean, and now look.
Listen, we played Dunes when it was Elvis's birthday. So as a tribute, we shot the TVs. Well, the TVs were from the 1950s. We get a bill for $1,100 for one TV. I go, "The Dunes is going under. They need our money." But we left that. And this is how big it was at one point. We left an individual Learjets that night that set four. So we had three or four of them looking at each other out the window. And we flew to Tahoe to do our first headlining gig, where I think was Caesar's Palace.
Now, what's the biggest place you guys played? I mean, if you remember, I mean,
size-wise?
Yeah, size-wise. But crowd-wise, what's the biggest crowd you guys performed in front of?
Bon Jovi asked us to come out and do Wild Thing his first or second time back to Giant Stadium in Jersey. So that's 80,000?
Yeah, wow.
For us, comedically, I think 40, 50.
It's just amazing because you don't really see it anymore. I mean, it was rock star. And then Dice Clay hit that level, too, mm-hmm. with the stadiums mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And
also, people forget, before the Kings of Comedy, the Queens of Comedy, the Arabs of this, the Jews of that, the Gypsies of this, the Outlaws of Comedy are the ones that broke that path for them.
It's crazy. And so, I mean, how long was your show then? I mean, you guys probably had to shorten your times.
No. It depended on where we were. Like when Mitzi Shore had the Dunes, the main room, my father was a gambler, so growing up I went to Vegas a lot. They used to do a show there at 2 in the morning, the celebrities, for the Help and the other celebrities.
All right.
Hadn't been done in 30 years. So I put in, let's do a 2 in the morning show. We did 40 shows or 38 shows in 2 weeks, broke Sinatra's attendance record. You could not get into that show. It would go off about 3:30 in the morning. And it would be the weirdest mixture. Paul Anka, Charlie Pride, Joan Rivers, Jane Fricke, all wanting to know how we're getting away with this. Nobody had cursed in Vegas.
Okay.
And it got so crazy, we went to see Sinatra's show, and Sinatra stops his show. "Hey, where are those outlaw guys? Stand up, you crazy bastards." You know. Then at first they wouldn't let us after we left the Dunes, be the opening show. We did the late show, so the opening show is the Smothers Brothers.
All right.
And you know, they're clean as clean can be. And in the middle of the act, Tommy turns his brother out of the blue, unplanned, and says the F word. There's dead silence in the room. He goes, what are you doing? He goes, those guys over there say it every night and everybody laughs. What the hell? And we were on the cover of every Vegas magazine. A critic said there's a new Rat Pack in town, and we ran it just like that.
Now, were you getting noticed everywhere you go? I mean,
we were on the cover of everything. Like, Sam comes into my room one night, and there's like 12 boxes piled up, and he goes, what's that? I go into a shirt store today. The guy recognized me. He goes, I'm the star of the show. Where'd you get me? I go get recognized at the store. So towards the end of my act, I said, you like my shirt? And I mentioned where I got it. And Sam goes, are you doing commercials?
Wow.
But so, women, we took the whole top floor of the Dunes.
And so you stayed there. For how long were you there?
Well, the Dunes we did for a couple of years, and they couldn't hold us. So we went to 5,000 seats at Bally's.
Okay.
But when we went, it was an event because every rocker we knew would come and stay. So on stage, you'd have Billy Idol, Jeffrey Osborne. I mean, the weirdest mixture of people just to do Wild Thing at the end with us. But then they'd stay to party. So there was a line of girls in the hallways, like, who are you here for? Billy, Alan, Carl?
It's just, you know, it's so funny because, you know, because I have comics on the show that haven't, or a club, I've been club. It's just, it's amazing to think it's such, I mean, you know, as a comic on the road, it's one thing, but, you know, and you can get laid and stuff like that. But, I mean, you guys were, I mean, you were bona fide rock stars, and you were before, I mean, there wasn't rock stars in comedy then. I mean, you guys were, you mixed.
No,
both,
we
you,
really
you
get no,
both
no
branches.
Credit for it. But even when I was do gigs on my own, like I do Stern, I'd sell out Rascals all week just by sitting on Stern. Who's the nicest, funniest guy in the world. And we had the world by the balls. I mean, we were offered movies. You know, Sam screwed everything up because he was a drug addict.
So did you guys break up before he passed away, or when did you guys break up, or how'd that all happen?
The Outlaws went on. I stopped in 90. I just couldn't take it anymore.
So after he passed, who was it? Did Jimmy Schubert join in at all?
Well, here's what happened. We started to get bored with Sam. You know, at some point, I'm
so like you're babysitting sometimes?
Yeah, I'm okay. Somewhat normal. If you'd leave the party, he'd threaten to fire you. His favorite thing at his home, here's a great story. He had a home on a cliff.
In L.A.?
Yeah, and, you know, it's the cement, how they cement the hills here. Well, his pool was cemented. And whenever you go to a party there, the only way out is the front door. And he would play party goalie, he called it. So you go for the door, and he knock you on your ass and go, party goalie! So I don't want to disturb the guy. I know he's nuts. I take a rope, and I lower myself down. I walk around. I get my car all the way down the canyon. You can hear him screaming, you're out! You're out! So after enough, you know, he ruined the movie. He ruined certain things that we had going. He lied. So I just said I had enough, and I left in 90, and I think he passes in 92.
So now when you leave, did any of the guys join you? Or
no, what happened, to answer your Schubert question, the last tour we did, he took out what he called the Junior Outlaws. There was a guy named Michael Jaselka, Jimmy Schubert, and Sparky Chervitz. And they would each do five, and some nights he'd let one of them do longer. So when I quit, Jimmy Schubert took the spot.
Okay, now, so then you went on your own then.
Mm-hmm. And then from there is when the Outlaws started to fall off because he was drugged up and canceling shows. And
so what was it like for you going out on your own? Was it different?
Because I had to start all over because we had the worst reputation in the world. In fact, when we played Caesars as headliners, Kravitz was with us. We hadn't had Mitchell Walters yet, Steve Kravitz.
Okay.
So they closed the pool for us at night. Now, we're used to stealing and being nobodies. They give us the pool, everything, but the bar was locked, so we broke into it. And then Kravitz, with the Jewish nose, jumps in the pool, comes up, bangs his nose on the side, and it looks like a shark attack. They have to drain the pool. They're so fed up with us. So now I leave Sam, and they had a lounge there that sat like 400. It was a very difficult room, but I played there for years at the Playboy Girls of Rock and Roll. You want to talk about a great gig. And so I'm going there. And this is my first gig, and it took me forever to get this because you call clubs and they go, oh, we don't want one of those outlaws.
Okay.
They'll break the place up. So I had my hair cut, and I'm sitting next to the guy that books it on the plane ride to Tahoe. And when I was talking, he goes, hey, you know any of those outlaw guys? And kind of, why? They will never work in a casino I have anything to do with, ever. I have a big red X through their pictures. Why would they break into a bar? Well, maybe they weren't used to getting stuff. So I come off the stage the second night, and the guy's holding my picture with the big red X. He goes, is this you? I goes, God, it really kind of looks like me. He goes, listen, you son of a bitch, if you weren't so funny, I'd throw you out of here. And he kept me there, and he kept me there a lot. But I had to start all over, and that's when I turned to writing.
Yeah, well, because I know I was looking, because I always do the IMDb on people. And now you wrote for Roseanne.
I turned to writing, and I was a joke writer for everybody. And what I did is people would give you 50, 100 a joke. I wouldn't do that. I said, I'm like an attorney. You give me 1,000 up front, I'll tell you when you owe me more.
Who was some of the people you wrote for, writing jokes for?
Over the years?
Yeah.
Pryor, George Wallace. My first joke was to Jimmy Walker.
Now, how
did Jimmy Walker's new book talks about it. He said, you know, Jimmy used to hire everybody.
Yeah, because I know he used to hire Letterman. That's why he's on
All
Letterman
them.
A lot.
Well, he managed them.
Okay.
And owned them. Letterman had to buy his way out of the contract.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
He had Leno. He had everybody that was hot. Leno, Boozler, Letterman. And he would pay them weekly to write jokes for him, like 20 guys. So I wrote the joke that got his first applause on The Tonight Show. So he says, hey, Alan, would you write for me? And he sends me from his company, Ebony Management, which turned into the lady that was managing Jay Leno that he fired when he got his show.
Okay.
Whatever her name is. So we're sitting there, and I look at the paper, and it's 3 or 4 columns, two-sided. It says, Jimmy will not say dynamite jokes, black jokes, the N-word, did it? And it went on and on and on. So I wrote on it, let me know when Jimmy wants to be funny.
Well,
I've never discussed it with Jimmy Walker. His book came out a couple months ago, and in there it said, I wanted to get a guy that was on the edge, that was a loose cannon. So I went to Alan Steven.
Wow.
And he wrote great jokes. I asked him to work for me, and then he told that story, and we've never discussed it. None of it.
That's funny. So you were writing jokes, but then how did you get into the TV situation? Because it's a big different.
I got Roseanne, you know, they didn't like women back in the 80s. And I saw her at the Denver Comedy Club.
But I was going to say, because she said Denver. I know she came out of there.
I said, I want her on the show with me this week. He goes, she's a pain in the ass. We don't think she's funny. And I go, well, here's the good news. Who are you? I said, I walk. So she went on the show with me, and then I took her around with me.
Because you
friends.
Met her at the club, and you always thought she was funny.
And we became good friends. I love Roseanne. And then Louis Anderson and I talked her into coming out here. The rest is history. Then she married a man I didn't like, and he didn't like me. And he wouldn't allow us to talk. Then she divorced him, bought me back in, and with a year, I was running her show.
So it must have been a lot different, because you go from this, you know, I mean, and comics, put it this way, comics, we have a very scattered lifestyle, but you're coming from, like, a rock star comic, so it's even worse. So you have to get...
The rock star thing had already been 4 years over for
Still,
me.
Still, though, man, you lived the life that most people could want, like, a week in your life is what people would pray for, like, 3 years.
I could tell you stories you wouldn't even believe me. So, Roseanne, I start in 94, so there's that 4 years. Now, when I start with her, I had done a talk show that's no longer on. They called up and said, listen, we're having a talk show on about Roseanne and Tom getting a divorce. Well, who's on the show? Comics from the Denver Comedy Club. Well, who's on? They told me. And I said, well, did one of them tell you used to make Roseanne sleep with her to get spot? No. I go, well, here's what the deal is. $1,000, first class airfare and a limo suite. Well, we don't do that. I go, go tell your boss what I just told you. They called back, said, we're sending you the ticket. Of course you are. So I think for the whole show, I get there, it's only a 10-minute segment. And the lady looks at me, first question, she wants to be hard-hitting, you know. It's trying to be like Oprah. She goes, Alan, Roseanne promised you a job on her show, and then you didn't get it. How do you feel about that? I go, if you live on promises in show business, you ought to get out. So she right away knows I'm not playing. She goes to the next guy, and she goes, Vince, she stopped talking to you when she became famous. And I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't talk to Vince, and I'm not famous.
Right.
You ever think he's an ass? Place breaks up. Well, I'm doing that through the whole thing. So the stage manager walks over and goes, they'd like you to do the whole show. So they get rid of the other comics. And the next people out might have been friends of Tom's. Then the next people out was his mother.
Tom's mother?
Yeah, and okay. Nixon had died. This is when Nixon died. So I'm talking to she, before the show comes on, she pinches me. I go, what's that? She goes, you're the enemy. I go, you're nuts. So somebody says, hey, is it true Tom Arnold used to swallow fish as one of his tricks? She goes, no, it was a trick. I said, no, it wasn't. He swallowed them. And she goes, why are we even talking about Tom? You know, Nixon just died. And I go, well, what kind of segue is that, lady? So we're like a bad app in Costello. I leave that, and I get a call from Tom Arnold. He and Roseanne are divorcing, and Tom hates me, so I know this is bull. He says, come to my trailer. He goes, give me 10 ideas. I'll try to get you on the show. He's using me, because she liked me, to try to get her back. Well, I never hear from him. She loves the ideas. He finally sends them to her, and she calls me up and says, why are you talking about me on TV? I go, why don't you listen to the show? I defended you. Like, you know, I think the last group on was Inquirer reporters.
Oh, okay.
And the one goes, I was on the movie set. It was disgusting. They were rolling around in the grass and kissing. I'm thinking, they're married. What's disgusting about
that? Right, right.
So I went, so what are you saying, lady? You don't want to date me? You know, just turning things upside down. So she said, well, what's doing? I want to do my stand-up again, and I'd love to have you do it. I well, you know, right now I'm being, I think I'm going to be homeless tomorrow, and I'm driving a car with two bullet holes in it. Knock on my door the next day, $25,000 check with a note. You want to work now?
Wow.
So I stayed in a trailer on the lot and used to secretly fix her scripts. And after about a year, she said, you know, would you mind working on my show? And I brought Rich Scheidner in with me.
Okay.
Normally he would have started at a lower price, but I negotiated for him. And we started with, I think, the second title to the bottom. And like I said, within a year or two, it was mine.
Now, did you enjoy that? I mean, compared from doing the live, because you did stand up and you did so many big venues.
The money is so damn ridiculous.
Okay.
And yes, I did enjoy it, but I didn't enjoy the situation. First of all, she has more writers than anybody in the history of TV. There's like 26 of them. And you can't, it's baby time. People are making $1 million and bitching. And I come from a different world. Like one guy said, this isn't the show I signed on to do. I said, you make $850,000 a year. You're welcome to go home.
Right, exactly.
Go tell your wife what you just told me or shut up. Well, they didn't like me. Like one day I come in and the writer's assistant goes, hey, Alan, do you think you can talk to the dead? I go, I do it all day long. No sense of humor.
See, that's just weird. You think it's your on a
no
comedy show.
No sense of humor. See, wow. And I'm coming pure from comedy off at this time. Well, it's a long story, but everything goes. And now it gives me credibility. And I'm also doing Arliss at the same time.
Yeah, I saw that because I love that show.
Thank you.
That was such a good show. It was so. It's one of those things. It's so funny because that was on HBO. And
7 years, people.
Yeah, and it's so funny because John Cassier was on a few weeks ago, and he was on the show First and 10. And they were both such great sports shows because you never really saw that they could do sports shows the way they should have been. You know, a network at the time couldn't have done it. And Arliss was just, I mean, I remember, because we knew Robert Wall from Hollywood Nights. We used to watch that movie, New Bomb Turrets. And it was a great show. And I saw that. That was just, it must have been a great thing because you guys were on cutting edge TV shows because you were on HBO.
Well, here's what was funny. We would bring agents in at the beginning of the year and say, hey, can you tell us some stories? And then if it was a boxing story, we'd change it to baseball. You know, some people went, no. And every agent would come in and go, I can't talk about my clients. Yeah, have a cup of coffee. We chit-chat. Half hour go by. Now we're going, can you give us initials? With an hour, they'd all sell out their clients. And we'd have stories.
See, that's, now you were writing for both at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did that work, though? In different seasons?
Well, Roseanne paid me so much damn money that I did her 5 days a week, sometimes seven, but Saturdays and Sundays, I would do, Arliss would start before Roseanne. So for a month, I would do break stories before they went to film. Then Roseanne would start, and I would rewrite the scripts Saturday and Sundays with Robert.
Okay. Now, stand-up was completely out of the picture.
I dropped stand-up, I guess, about a year after I was on the Roseanne show.
And now, after Arliss, I know, well, where did you go from there?
Arliss goes to about 2001.
So you worked for Roseanne for how long?
Four years.
So basically, and you doubled. So you still, I mean, you've been writing for 7-8 years, so you're at the top of your game. I mean, so was it, did you just get, did it just come knowledgeable? Did it just come second nature to you to write?
I'm very good with story. And the only thing I can put it to is when I was a kid, I used to have to go to bed, no TV, so I'd watch it without sound.
Okay.
So I'd have to figure out what David Jansen's running from.
It's funny you said it. I used to do that when the Phillies would play the Dodgers or the Padres. The games be on at 10:30 on like channel 17.
Yeah, but with the games you can see.
Yeah,
the
but
score.
I used to always turn it down too because I love sports.
Me,
so
I'd have to figure out why'd the girl kill him.
Yeah. So after Arliss ended, and why did that go off? Was it just? I mean, it was such
7 years. It ran its course. Okay. You know, it's hard to stay on longer than that on
right.
HBO. Plus, people thought we did 3 years. They moved us around so much, but then they hit gold. It went Sex and the City, Us, Sopranos, or
okay.
vice versa. And you couldn't beat that night. Could not beat that night.
We have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
So what would you like to talk about? Another story? It's up
lunch?
To you.
No, I'm kidding.
Yes.
Geez, what else would you like to hear?
Well, no, so you don't perform anymore at all?
I started again in 2001. I went back to the comedy store.
Okay.
And then as Mitzi started to get sick, she had this in her mind, I'm trying to steal the stores from her. So then I stopped again, and then I got the bug, and I called up Jamie. So I do the Laugh Factory every Saturday night.
Okay.
And if somebody knows who I am and calls me, like I did Laughlin, Nevada last year for 2 nights, if the money's right, I'll go out. But I don't need it, and I'm thinking about opening a club myself here in town.
See, that's cool, because you know, it's so funny. You do go back because you enjoyed it. Like me, I was out of it. See, I was out of it for 10 years, and I just got back into it, and then I started doing this, and for me now, it's fun, and I don't sit there, and I'm not going to run the club to do 7 minutes, but for me, my girlfriend lives back east, so when I go back, I have all my old connections, so I play the club in Cherry Hill. The play is Marlon in Bristol, PA, and that's what's great. I mean,
For me, I'm getting a divorce, and where else can I find 24-year-olds? They want Elvis on stage.
How long were you married?
Sabrina was 15 when I met her. Married her at... No, I got with her at 25. I think married her at 30.
Okay.
So we were married 10 years.
All right. Well,
we're still married.
Any shows coming up that people can check you out on?
I have a bunch of stuff in the works. One, go to trilogy.net, TRIL3Y. And that's another business I have where we'll be taking films all over the country, showing them unedited, all the trilogies, Lord of the Rings,
okay.
Narnia, in theaters that you've never seen it in before. Here in town, we're doing it at the Los Angeles Theater in May that was built for Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
And it's you get 3 meals. It's a full, full day of shopping.
I can't imagine.
And then I have a couple shows in development that we're just waiting to pull the trigger on.
Now, how can people get in touch with you, or how can they follow you? Is there any? Do you tweet? Are you Twitter?
I just started to do that. You know, I'm so old. I hate to say old-fashioned, but even if I was doing it now, I'm not the type of guy to go, "Hey, thank you. I'll be in the back selling a T-shirt."
Okay.
I know today they need it because it makes up their money.
Right.
But to me, that's somebody else's business. You know what I mean? I was even when I performed, I wasn't good at that. One time at Comedy Castle in Detroit, Jay Leno, everybody recommended me. He went book me. So he says, "Do you have a picture?" I said, "You want one of me smiling?" He goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "So you know I'm funny, asshole." Of course, I never worked for him. I didn't send tapes. I don't do any of that.
So, but how can people follow you? Can they get in touch with you? Because, you know, it's like you have a lot of
shit. They can call
going
my
on.
Agent.
But you're on Facebook.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
yeah.
where I found you.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you were on Dante's show, I believe. And
I love Dante.
And I worked with him when I got out of business. I got back and I used to be in San Diego with me, him, Bobby
Dante
Lee.
Dante was a doorman at the La Jolla Comedy Store.
Okay.
And when I used to rock down there, so I loved Dante.
Was Fred Burns there when you worked there?
Freddie.
Yeah, because I remember when I did it, I was in San Diego for a little bit. This is years ago. And then he left and started his own club. Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing. Then he came back and it was...
Yeah, Freddie caught the tail end of me.
Okay.
You know, a little bit. But, you know, I was with the store since its inception almost.
See, that's just amazing. But I want to thank you for coming on.
I want to thank you for asking me. This is a lot of fun.
I love the stories. And that's the thing. It's one thing that, you know, it's...
I got thousands of them.
Yeah,
anytime
so we're gonna have to bring you back.
Day,
we're gonna have to bring you back because they my guess.
And I'm
my,
willing to rat everybody out.
And that's good. My listeners know that. My listeners know I love stories. It's like when the guy like you has so many stories comes on, I don't interrupt, I don't talk as much. It's like when Tom Jason was on or people like that. I want to hear stories.
Next time I'm in, I'll tell you about all the people that smoke pot that would shock you or do drugs.
We are doing that. Send me an email. We're gonna get Alan Steven back on, but send me an email if you want. Cooper at Indy 100, Cooper Indy 100, INDIE100.com. Send me an email. Tell me if there's any guests you want. You know, I'll try to get them. Sometimes I can't. Sometimes I can. Also, follow me at Twitter. It's at Cooper Talk. You can see what's going on in my life at Cooper Talk. I post a lot of funny things. If you want to hear past episodes, go to www.coopertalk.net. I have about 150 episodes up there. Or you can go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio, type in one word, Cooper Talk, as you get all discombobulated. People from South Jersey, Friday, March 15th, I will be at the Marlton Comedy Cabaret at Casa Carollo in 73 with the amazing legendary Wid,
Oh, my God.
Yeah, a comedy legend, people. Me, myself, and him, and John Kinsel. And I want to thank you again, Alan. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on. People, remember, listen every week. Next week, I'll be having Dom Irrera and Bruce Fine as my guests. Also, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. You guys have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.